an EMT librarian, pedestrian trauma and the elderly, all hazards planning, and we'll take a look at treating patients with blast injuries like those seen in recent weeks in the country. If that's what you're looking for, you found it right here on this week's episode of The Medic Cast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is The Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Medic Cast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to this week's episode. We have a great show coming up for you in this week's episode, and I hope you'll stick around and check out everything we have to offer, including news articles on a news article on an EMT librarian who helps out and rides along, helping EMS educators and providers find evidence-based research to back up their EMS practice. Plus, we'll take a look at some in-depth information on dealing with patients who have suffered blast injuries in this week's Tip of the Week. All of that coming up soon here on this week's episode of The Medic Cast. Before we get to all that, though, please make sure you check out all of the information, links, additional resources, and everything else available for you over at The Medic Cast blog. You'll find that at medicast.com/blog. There's a show notes link at the top of the page. Click that link, and it'll take you right to the most recent episode and other listings. You can scroll down there to find any previous episode that you might be looking for. There's also a search box there for you on the right-hand side of the site if you're looking for something in particular. So I urge you to take some time and make sure you follow up on the information you get on the show each week. Make sure you understand how it applies to your own EMS practice and protocols. If you want to get back in touch with me, make sure you do so. I hope you'll reach out to me by email. You can shoot those emails into me to podmedic@mac.com. Shoot me an email with your questions, your comments, anything you have on the shows. You can send me suggestions or interview ideas for future episodes. Either way, I work hard to respond back to every email that comes in, and I will get back to you as well. So, you know, keep those emails coming in, whatever the case may be. If you're an Android user, I also want to let you know to check out the brand new free MedicCast app in the Google Play Store. iPhone and iPad users, stand by. There'll be a free MedicCast iOS app coming soon. That's enough contact info. We'll get into this week's episode coming up with the news. But please, before I get into that, remember to support our sponsors. Let them know you heard about them here on the MedicCast. It helps keep the show coming out for you each week free of charge, and it keeps the lights on here at our humble MedicCast studios. Take a moment and tell them thanks for supporting the show. Kicking off the news this week is a feature article on another EMS blogger I found over at emsworld.com. It's on Casey Allgood, an EMT and librarian who is working alongside EMS providers in the Indianapolis area to help provide them research assistance into the best in evidence-based medical care for EMS providers. She received a Sewell Fellowship grant to fund her riding along with EMS crews there to better understand their needs and to help find the type of research that needs to be done as an EMS professional. As an embedded librarian under the grant, she is tasked with the object of learning all she can about the business, tasks, and language associated with her target, in this case, an EMS service, and she will go ahead and help them find keyword searches and other information they need. She also writes a blog about her experiences. You can find that at ambulanceridinglibrarian.com. Some of the topics she's looked at in research include cardiac issues like congestive heart failure, resuscitation care, and pediatric respiratory care. She uses what she sees and learns on the ambulance to then go back and dig into specialized library databases and search engines to dig up existing research, maybe even software or mobile apps that'll assist the folks in the field. Her ultimate goal is to increase the amount of available literature and research around emergency medical care so that all of us and our leadership can have access to it to improve the care we provide every single day. Head over and check out her blog and see what she's learning from us as she helps us learn more about ourselves. So I hope you'll check that out. There'll be a link in the show notes. Again, you can find her at ambulancewritinglibrarian.com, and you can also find that link in the show notes for this episode. Researchers at the Centers for Disease Control recently released a report on elderly pedestrians, saying that they are far more likely to die in a traffic accident than others. Now, as the population continues to age, we can expect to have a lot more traffic accidents involving elderly pedestrians. It's something we need to keep our eyes open for. It makes sense when you think about it. Elderly trauma patients are all more likely to die due to so many things like their comorbid factors, brittle bones, declines in vision and hearing, plus all of the additional chronic illnesses associated with aging. Elderly patients are just more likely to be unable to compensate for serious traumatic injury. Now, it follows that as pedestrians, the elderly are also more at risk. They are less likely to detect oncoming vehicles or be able to successfully avoid collision when it's detected because their sensory and mobility deficits just impede them. Now, when they're struck, their bones are more likely to break due to their brittle nature. Injuries sustained that cause shock are more likely to cause a fatal reaction because of the impaired compensatory mechanisms that they might have associated with things like diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and even the medications they're taking to treat some of these disorders. Additional information that came out of the data released by the CDC was that men were more likely than women to be struck and killed by a motor vehicle. But it was interesting because this additional data point may actually reflect more risk-taking behaviors by males, or that men tend to be found walking in more dangerous traffic areas. We're not really sure. Whatever the case may be, studies like this one help to remind us that we have to be prepared to aggressively treat and manage certain patient populations, including the elderly. And these trauma patients are important for us to keep in mind. We need to give them the best chance to survive their injuries, and we have to err on the side of caution when assessing these patients, assuming more injury likelihood based solely on the mechanism of injury and their age. Now, if we do these things, we'll be more likely to have a positive patient outcome. And not only that, we'll also be able to avoid having a patient become one of these CDC statistics. Finally, I want to bring your attention to the all hazards concept of planning and preparedness for major events like the one that happened in Boston on April 15th. Many individuals, paid and volunteer responders, were in attendance expecting a large community event with all of the common medical and minor traumas that go along with it. So instead, what they ended up with in the space of just a few moments was a major mass casualty incident with many multi-system trauma patients. Now, how a responder deals with this sudden change is actually a reflection of their training and their planning that has happened well before this event ever began. And I think it's important to keep in mind that this happened well before the running of the marathon. Every community has large events of one sort or another, maybe not on the scale of something like the Boston Marathon, but for your community, it may seem just as large. I know in my community, we have regular events that include parades, festivals, and fairs. We have several large community organizations, and these places hold regular meetings like our local churches and our civic organizations. All of these are potential soft targets for a person intent on doing a large number of casualties to a large group of people. Add in the potential for natural disasters that can happen from time to time, and pre-planning for events like this may seem all but impossible. But I assure you that while it may seem complex, it's actually a little bit easier than it seems using this all-hazards approach. Many events have similar response modalities. It doesn't matter if the explosion is from a man-made device like it was in Boston, or a freak accident like what happened in West Texas. The injuries you expect to see will be similar. The same is true of collapsed buildings related to a natural disaster. It doesn't matter if the building collapsed from a tornado or from an earthquake. A crush injury is a crush injury. So you'll see that Using this all hazards planning approach, it can be complex but not impossible to plan and prepare for things that might happen in your community. And that's the point that's often brought up by my friend Rick Rosati over at the Mitigation Journal podcast. All hazards planning starts with the same steps we all know from our normal patient assessment process. We just scale that process up to handle multiple patients. There's a lot more to do, and there's a lot more to this, but I think you'll be better served by reading the article I found over at emsworld.com. There's a link in the show notes to it, and make sure you check out that article, and also check out Rick Rosati's podcast, The Mitigation Journal. You can find that at mitigationjournal.org. Do these things and put together your own all-hazards plan for how you'll deal with major events when they might happen to fall in your lap. This week on the show, for our tip of the week, I'll be bringing you a review of dealing with blast injuries. You know, in light of all the tragedies that have happened in the previous couple of weeks, including the Boston Marathon bombing, as well as the West Texas fertilizer plant explosion, we should all probably be paying a little more attention to blast injuries and what it takes to deal with them. I found some really good materials to share with you and some excellent links that'll be in the additional resources on the show notes for this page, so make sure you follow up on that stuff. And the next two tip segments here at the Medicast will be on blast injuries. So let's get into part one of that series, dealing with blast injuries. So let's take a look at blast injuries in this tip segment. We'll kick off with part one and just talk a little bit about our objectives. We're going to look at statistics involving blast injuries. This is not something that happens all that commonly, but it's more common than you might think, and we'll look at some of those statistics. Types of blast injuries that you might expect to see, including the anatomy of blast injuries and what kind of injuries specific to different areas of the body we might expect to see from the various types of blast injuries. We'll talk also about treatment for blast injuries, and finally, response considerations and treatment considerations. If you're in a situation where you are going to be treating patients immediately at the injury site, or patients from a blast injury coming into your hospital even, there's going to be some things you need to keep in mind. So we'll talk about those considerations as well. And then specific resources that you can use to follow up. There's a lot of good information that the federal government has provided for us on blast injuries, on treating and recognizing blast injuries. And so we're going to talk about some of those resources that are available for you to follow up, because, of course, this is a short coverage here on the show, but we'll do a lot more if you are able to go and follow up on the tons of additional resources that are out there. And I'll provide links to all of that. So let's talk about some of the stats. In the last 30 years in the U.S., there have been a significant number of blast incidents, more than you might think. 36,000 blast injuries. That's more than 1,000 a year, which is significant to keep in mind that these things happen. And they can be intentional blasts and explosions, or they could be unintentional explosions, but they do happen. More than 6,000 people were injured. More than 700 people died in these explosions. So this is something that you could conceivably see in the course of your career, and something that you should be prepared for. Some of the statistics that we looked at here, looking at different types of terrorist bombings versus conventional trauma. And it's important to look at the injury severity score, the Glasgow Coma scores here on this chart. And you'll see that based on the injuries from a bombing, an intentional explosion event, blast injury, the injury severity score is much worse than you would see in other conventional trauma situations. The same thing with a lower Glasgow Coma score. More people with lower Glasgow Coma scores seen in a bombing event than are seen in other trauma on average. And you see other types of other signs of severe injury, low blood pressure from presumably from blood loss, ICU admissions, injuries to more than three body regions, surgical procedures required. This is significant. More than 50% of the people in a bombing require some kind of surgical procedure, which is much larger than what you would see in other traumas. Other trauma events, more like 35-36% seen in that. And in-hospital mortality is significantly higher than other trauma. So blast injuries are something to pay attention to, and you can certainly suspect a higher degree of injury to your patient when you receive those patients. So what types of injuries are we talking about here? Well, they classify injuries occurring from a blast in several ways to define exactly what causes the injury to the body. The primary blast injury, okay, so if you're talking about primary, secondary, tertiary blast injuries, primary blast injuries happen from the overpressure blast wave. This is not shrapnel. It is actually the concussive force of the blast striking the body. And this overpressure wave that strikes from the explosion itself, and if you've ever seen high-speed photography of an explosion, you actually can see that blast wave as it disturbs dust moving away from the center of the blast. And it's leading, it's ahead of any particles or any debris that is blown out from the explosion and leads that. So this is a primary thing that strikes someone. And primary blast injury is significant. Most significant injury that happens from this is, most common injury is a tympanic membrane rupture. And of course, that is not the only significant injury or the most serious injury, but it is one of the most common seen. And this can be seen significant distance away from the initial blast, depending on the type of explosive used. There's also pulmonary damage. And again, and think about this, it's this overpressure wave comes through, hollow organs are going to be affected as the pressure wave goes through them and causes internal damage. And you actually have pulmonary damage, pulmonary contusions, which can lead to injury a day or two later as the bruising in the lungs causes pulmonary edema. So it's something to be aware of. Also, you can have pneumothorax and other things happening from this overpressure wave and hollow organ damage. It is worse in a confined space. And this makes sense. If an explosion happens inside of a building, then the pressure wave is contained inside the building and intensified. Whereas if the blast happens out in an open space, there's plenty of space for the blast wave and the overpressure to spread out and is unhindered and not reflected back onto someone. So, and that makes sense when you think about it. Secondary blast injuries are from the projectiles and often include penetrating injury. So the fragments of the bomb itself, the debris from surrounding objects that are thrown, including debris from other persons. In the bombing in Boston, they talked about zippers that were found embedded in wounds. So somebody's jacket, the zipper became a projectile in the blast and was either embedded in them or became embedded in a neighboring person from the effects of that blast. So this can be fragments of various things, including intentionally included fragments and shrapnel that might be part of the bomb-making device. In the case of West Texas, where it was an unintentional explosion, those fragments could be parts of your house, the lumber and splinters from your home, glass from your windows. These can all be projectile things that cause penetrating injury. Can also cause blunt force trauma. If something large were to strike you, it wouldn't penetrate, but it would cause blunt force. And this is dependent upon a couple of things, including how the device is made, if it's an intentional bombing. And one of the things they talked about a lot in the news in Boston was that this was a homemade device. They weren't using a very sophisticated explosive, and the explosive did not cause as much injury as something like a more sophisticated explosive, a plastic explosive, or a military-grade explosive would cause a whole lot more injury for the size of the device than what was caused in Boston. So the homemade ingredients used in the bomb actually reduced the amount of injury, and that seems kind of shocking when you think about the amount of injuries that happened in Boston. But it was reduced significantly, experts say, because the type of device and the type of explosive used changed the types of injuries that occurred. And so you can expect, different types of injuries, primary and secondary blast injuries, to occur differently depending on what actually exploded. Tertiary blast injuries
are the actual victim gets moved. Okay, so the victim is lifted off their feet and blown a distance, and it's that landing that of the individual that causes problems. This is primarily blunt force trauma, although if they land on something else that causes a penetrating injury, that could be considered a tertiary blast injury as well. But it is something that physically moves the person, and they got knocked down and then struck their head. Tertiary blast injury, blunt force trauma to the head related to being knocked off their feet. So you can see how it's hard sometimes to classify what exactly caused the injury, but it can cause different levels of injury to the person. So you have to think about how close they were to the explosive device and what caused the injury that you're looking at. This is also where traumatic amputations happen. We saw this a lot in Boston, where people had actually the limbs blown off. The amputations didn't happen in the hospital in many cases. The amputations happened on the scene, and the hospital just cleaned up the remaining parts of limbs. So this was traumatic amputation causing a displacement of a part of the victim. This will also cause fractures from the blunt force trauma from the blow to when they land and are forced into another object. That would cause fractures and injuries. So the blast wave and the landing is what we're looking at here with tertiary blast injuries. Quaternary blast injuries, the fourth level of blast injury, is everything else. Okay, anything else that you can think of. So this could include burns, exposure to chemicals or radiation, like in the case of a dirty bomb, a so-called dirty bomb that includes low-level radioactive material that is dispersed over an area by a bomb. That would be a quaternary blast injury. Everything else that's caused by the blast. So, if the blast is a fiery blast, then the burns to the victims would be from the quaternary blast injuries. It also includes crush injuries that might happen as a result of building collapse or something like that that happens after the initial explosion. Building becomes weakened and then the building collapses. That kind of crush injury can happen as well. And we also include in this any kind of underlying comorbidities that the patient might have. So exacerbation of their existing illnesses, patients with existing cardiovascular disease. You know, if someone is involved in an explosion and the problems involving that explosion cause them to become extremely stressed and have a heart attack, that myocardial infarction could be considered a quaternary blast injury if it occurred immediately following the event, because it could be said the stress of the event caused that. Dust and things in the air exacerbating asthma would be a quaternary blast injury. Just some examples of things you can think about. But this is certainly, again, part of the blast event. So that's going to wrap up this initial segment on blast injuries. And we'll go ahead and figure out what's going on with the entire body, with the anatomy of blast injuries, treatments of some of the blast injuries, and managing special considerations for blast injuries. And that'll all be coming up in the next episode. But again, I urge you to follow up on the show notes for this episode and check out the excellent additional resources that I've been able to lay down there in the links for you. So there's links there from the American College of Emergency Physicians. They actually partnered with the federal government, the CDC and FEMA to put together a primer on blast injuries that looks at all of the aspects. And I pull a lot of information from that for this presentation, but I got to tell you, there was so much there that I could have done 3 hours on blast injuries and still not covered at all. So you really can find a lot of information there, including tutorials, videos, and things like that that'll all help lead you through even more in-depth information if that's what you want to look for. Check back next week with the second part of this episode, and that's going to wrap up this tip segment.
And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show this week. And I please want to especially remind you to follow up on all of the information in this week's show over at mediccast.com/blog. Over there, you'll find the show notes link at the top of the page. You can just take a moment, follow up on the information and links to the news items you find in the show, to the tip segments, all of that stuff. You can definitely catch that information there. You can also sign up for our email newsletter. It brings you those links directly to your email inbox every week. That's a form right there on the website, right on the right-hand side of the page. Fill that out and get the newsletter from the MedicCast sent directly to your email inbox. I also welcome your comments and suggestions by email. So if you want to shoot me an email to podmedic@mac.com. You can send in your news links, ideas for future show topics, or interviews, or whatever comments you might have. I really look forward to hearing from you, and I do make sure I get back to every single email that comes in. I work hard to do that, so please keep those emails coming. They give me a lot of energy, and they give me ideas for future shows, and maybe I'll be able to share that here for you. If you want to catch up with me on social media pages and sites, you can find me most of the places under the handle PodMedic. That means twitter.com/PodMedic, facebook.com/PodMedic. So make sure you friend or follow me in those locations. You can also check out the MedicCast on our Facebook page. Now over 4,000 followers there. Head over to facebook.com/MedicCast. Click the like button at the top of the page and join the community over on Facebook. That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. Please make sure you spread the word about the show and share the MedicCast with all of your colleagues and your students, if you have any, in the EMS world. I'll be back here each week with new episodes, interviews, tips, and more every Monday morning so you can start off your EMS week with the show. Tell someone else about the MedicCast today. I'm Jamie Davis, the PodMedic. It's time to close out the show. Don't forget to thank our sponsors, and remember, folks, Scene Safety, BSI.